From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Maggie Wall. This week we look at an effort to loosen pollution standards in salmon streams. A new book being published this month tells the story of the salmon canning industry and includes wonderful color photos of old historic salmon can labels. And we finish up with a story of two guys who did everything right to help rescuers find them. We share tips on what to do to increase your chances of being found and rescued. All that coming up on this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report, right after this.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs, 1-800-992-4960, or online at alaskaboat.com.
The Trump administration is quietly reviving its consideration of a long-stalled effort in Alaska to loosen pollution standards where fish spawn. State regulators proposed the rule change more than a decade ago that changes how it enforces the Federal Clean Water Act. But it still needs approval from the Environmental Protection Agency. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, opponents warn if EPA gives the rule the thumbs up, it could help pave the way for controversial projects like Pebble Mine.
The Clean Water Act is the primary tool used by the feds to regulate water pollution. Industry often argues these standards are difficult to meet. Just ask guys like Frank Bergstrom, an Alaska mining consultant with 40 years of experience.
Alaska is a beautiful, pristine place, and there is no pollution, and certainly the background water quality is excellent. So if you follow the Clean Water Act to the detail, you pretty much have to discharge distilled water.
That's a bit of a stretch. Basically, the rules say you can't degrade water bodies. But years ago, Alaska and other states took the industry's view in mind when it came up with mixing zones. This compromise allows things like wastewater plants, mines, and oil refineries to exceed pollution standards in designated areas. If they're held within agreed-on limits, the courts have generally held this would be allowed. Environmentalists don't agree. Bob Shavelson heads up advocacy for Cook Inlet Keeper in Homer.
Mixing zones embrace this old, tired notion that dilution is the solution to pollution. It only came about when lawyers from oil, gas, and mining corporations wanted to push this in through rulemaking.
There are clear limits. Alaska doesn't allow mixing zones where fish spawn. But in 2004, Governor Frank Murkowski's administration proposed adding exceptions to that ban. It was panned by the fishing industry, and opposition was overwhelming at public hearings held in 2005. The two-year effort seemed to die quietly. But now, more than a decade later, it's back. EPA's regional office sent a letter to Alaska tribes last December, notifying them that the DEC's 13-year-old rule is now under consideration. Shavelson notes that tribal consultation is one of the boxes the feds need to check before they can rubber stamp it.
This is an old rule that we thought we had beat back at the EPA level, but here it is rearing its head again.
Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska has asked for more information. The tribe's resource manager, Desiree Duncan, says,
our big concern is the fish spawning areas and the effects that that will have on our fisheries and our subsistence way of life.
Proponents point out that the revised rule still contains language to protect fish spawning. Bergstrom calls it a common sense approach.
This allows science to be used here to see whether or not there is an impact. If there is going to be an impact, then it's either going to be mitigated or it's not going to happen.
Environmental attorney Vicki Clark looked at those protections. She put it this way.
It's something where you could basically drive a truck through the loophole.
Her organization, Trustees for Alaska, is a vocal opponent to the proposed Pebble Mine at the headwaters of Bristol Bay, and she's worried about this rule's timing.
I'm speculating to a certain degree, but we have the Pebble Project moving forward with an EIS for their wetlands permitting, and we have the oil and gas facilities in Cook Inlet that are starting their process for a new permit, and mixing zones are part of those. And so it's just very interesting that this is coming forward and now moving through EPA, where there is no more public process.
EPA staff declined several interview requests. The regional office released a statement confirming that it's in contact with tribes. It also said it's consulting with the National Marine Fisheries Service for impacts to listed endangered species, another box it has to check. The federal agency referred further questions to state DEC. DEC staff declined to comment. Instead, it provided talking points prepared in 2005 by Governor Murkowski's administration. Then it referred questions back to the EPA. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, on the web at alaskaseafood.org.
About a century and a half of history, told through the ups and downs of the salmon canning industry in southeast Alaska, is the focus of a new book due to be released later this month. Tin Can Country, Southeast Alaska's Historic Salmon Canneries, is the work of Petersburg resident Karen Hofstad. It's a coffee table-sized book with Hofstad's colorful and historic collection of salmon can labels sprinkled throughout. Joe Vignicki spoke with Hofstad about the book and the decades of research that went into it.
Tin Can Country tells the story of salmon canneries around Southeast, from Excursion Inlet to Cake, Petersburg, Wrangell, Klawock, and Ketchikan. It also tells of the workers in those canneries and the fish traps that supplied them before statehood. It springs from the collection of salmon cans and labels that Petersburg resident Karen Hofstad first started in 1960. Ever since, she's been gathering more and researching the brands and history behind them.
I had all this stuff in my house that I've been accumulating, collecting. Just remember, younger people won't know this, but this all was all before Googling and computers and cell phones and stuff, you know. So now it's you can click and get this, but I had never done any of that. So I'm proud of that fact, too. I did it searching. I was a detective for a long time.
Hofstad was also researching the history of fishing in Southeast, and she found an ally in that effort in the late historian Pat Ropel of Wrangell. Ropel was compiling her own research on the history of the industry, but didn't finish her work before she died in 2015. Her family ended up donating that research to the Alaska State Library's historical collections. That's also where Hofstad ended up donating her can label collection. Ropel's research is found throughout this new book, as is the writing of some other well-known names in the region. For the past 3 years, Hofstad has been working with Angeli Grantham of Juneau, who edited and also contributed to the book. Grantham, originally from Kodiak, now works for the Alaska State Museum and has also worked as director of the Alaska Historical Society's Historic Canneries Initiative. The history goes back to the beginning of the industry in the 1870s with the first cannery in Klawock. It doesn't profile every operation around the region, but focuses on some of the most notable or historic. There are 116 cannery locations noted around Southeast, along with a map of those sites and a time frame for those facilities.
There's so much history in here of Southeast that people have no idea. You know, it's amazing. You know, we have German prisoners of war were working up in Excursion Inlet, you know, during World War II. And it covers every facet.
The book also details how cans are made and how salmon is processed and packed, along with the machinery used to can Southeast catch and the people who've made that happen. There's also great information on the artwork on the can labels themselves and how those labels evolved over time. Hofstad explains, and looking back, the industry had a hard go of it from the start.
It was not easy right from the beginning. A lot of bankruptcies, a lot of con men, a lot of deaths, suicides, all these things, merging and then falling apart. You know, nothing's really changed. Mm-hmm. And I think the word that Ann Julie pulled up, I thought so much when she wrote the afterword here, was resilience.
In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vignicki.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families.
We finish up this week with the story of a couple of guys who got into trouble, needed to be rescued, and because they did so many things right, they were returned safely to their families. They weren't out fishing, but we're including the story here because, one, it has a happy ending, and who doesn't love a happy ending? And two, there are a lot of important lessons for fishermen and others who find themselves in trouble or stranded on a beach somewhere. The Coast Guard Air Station in Kodiak rescued two men who went out on all-terrain vehicles to a remote but popular recreational site south of Kodiak. One ATV broke down and the other got bogged down in the muck. That left the guys out of luck, out of reach and literally out in the cold. Luckily, they had told their families where they would be and when to expect them back. So when they missed their come-home time, the families notified the Alaska State Troopers, who asked the Coast Guard for aerial support in the search. Coast Guard Petty Officer Nate Littlejohn is a 17th Coast Guard District Public Affairs Specialist based in Anchorage. He said the men were able to make it to a cabin after being forced to abandon their ATVs.
An MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter crew from Air Station Kodiak located the men after detecting their heat signatures inside a cabin near Saltery Cove. As the helicopter approached the cabin, the crew could see smoke rising from the chimney and the word help spelled out with driftwood in the cabin's driveway.
Littlejohn said it took two tries to find the men. The first trip out, the helicopter crew searched for several hours in low visibility before finding the two ATVs, but not the drivers. By then, the Hilo was low on fuel, so it had to pause the search to return to Air Station Kodiak to top up.
After refueling, they headed back out and began to double-check some of the places they'd already looked, which included numerous cabins near the abandoned ATVs. The helicopter crew used a forward-looking infrared camera on the helicopter to look for human heat signatures, and they found the men in a cabin they'd already checked earlier in the day.
Littlejohn said the men were in the early stages of hypothermia when they entered the cabin and started a fire to get warm. He said the takeaway from this incident is that the men did just what a person in trouble should do if they are out in the weather and facing hypothermia.
They found the closest logical option to warm themselves very quickly, and they also found a way to attract the attention of search crews.
The two men were reunited with their families on the tarmac at Air Station Kodiak. So let's review. Make sure someone knows where you are going and when you expect to return. At some point, you must accept the fact that you are in trouble and immediately make plans for survival. Best to do this before you get too hypothermic to be able to help yourself. Seek shelter and get warm as fast as you can. Make an obvious visible sign that you need help, the way these guys did with the driftwood in the driveway. In this case, the driftwood helped also served to alert rescuers that they were in this particular cabin. And here is a cool extra to remember when you are cold and discouraged. The Coast Guard has special heat-sensing equipment that can see people through cabin walls. Good job there, both to the victims and to the rescuers.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries.
That's it for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from Jacob Resnick with Coast Alaska in Juneau and Joe Bitnicki at KFSK in Petersburg. Whether you fish commercially, sports fish, or fish for subsistence, remember, life jackets really do save lives. And so does letting people know where you are going and when to expect you back. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Maggie Wong.